I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that out loud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of I Do Not Have Trash Politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Seen, the podcast. Throughout this season on the podcast, we've been talking about change, exploring some of the different emotions and stages of a growth process. But transformation is more than what we can intellectualize, more than what we can break down into psychological or political or practical concepts. There's also a mystery, a magic, an alchemy that runs beneath the surface of our lives, that supports and surprises and collaborates with us in unexpected ways. Some of us may understand this as spirit, as the universe, as the divine, as God. Some may struggle to connect to or believe in any of that. And some of us fall somewhere in the middle. I know I personally have been in all three of those camps. So for this episode, we wanted to talk to someone who is deeply grounded in both spiritual practice and deep thought about what spirituality is, what it means, and how it can support our healing and our liberation. And we were lucky enough to get to sit down with Marcelite Fayella. Marcelite is a Black and biracial educator and scholar of African heritage religions. Through a Black feminist lens, her work explores how religions such as Yoruba Ifa, Haitian Voodoo, and North American Hoodoo are used for collective healing and social justice. As a practitioner of both Ifa and Hoodoo, and a self-identified Black witch, Fayella often holds ceremonial space in academic and community settings. Fayella is a PhD candidate at Emory University. Join us for a conversation with Marcelite and stick around after the interview to hear our reflections on what we learned. So Marcelite, thank you so much for being here with us. We're so excited to sit down with you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I just wanted to start by checking in, just asking you how you're feeling, how you're arriving in the space today.
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling productive. I got up early this morning. And I'm making the final edits on my dissertation. I know. So it feels good. And it's getting done. And I just take it comment by comment and don't overwhelm and get like, you know, maybe 10, 15 pages done a day. And it's getting done. So I'm feeling good. I'm feeling at peace and at ease today.
So glad to hear that. And wow, what an incredible accomplishment.
Yeah, pre-congratulations.
Thanks. Thank you.
Sounds like you're on your way. So I know it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
So I met you many, many years ago. You were doing a documentary on mixed race identity. And it's been such a pleasure to be able to keep up with your work on social media since then. And just seeing you like around on like various podcasts and various spaces online. So I know from that connection with you on socials that spirituality isn't just something that you study. It's something that you have a very deep personal connection to. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you developed a connection with spirituality and what it means to you. I know that's a huge question, but just anything you feel comfortable sharing.
That's a great question. So I grew up in a mixed race family. My mom's African American. My dad's Italian, outside of Portland, Oregon. And it's very rural. I grew up on a farmhouse with like this big mountain, White East or Mount Hood, across that we could see from our dining room table. And that was very spiritual, just being in nature. My dad's from the Bronx and my mom's from Newark. So they were trying to get as far away from that as from New York City. I ended up returning to New York City, but that's another story. So being in nature was a very spiritual part of my upbringing. And I would sit for hours and tell myself stories and talk to the mountain and talk to the trees, connecting to something outside of myself. And then my mom is also very spiritual. So I would say she practices an eclectic, like Africana spirituality. I think she was drawn to Kemet and a little bit of Odisha. Oshun was definitely a part of my upbringing. But things like tarot and kind of whatever she could find pieced together that wasn't, she was leaving the Catholic Church. So whatever she could find that was Black and that was like not necessarily Christian, right? So I grew up doing spells and doing tarot. We did tarot at my 10th or 11th birthday party. All the Christian kids were really freaked out. And then when I got older, I found hoodoo and I found Odisha and I found a woman of color healing space in Brooklyn. And it was very much about healing and connecting to African diasporic spiritual practices. And then I went to Brazil and saw the similar practices in the Bronx as in Brazil. So it's kind of making the full connection between within the diaspora. So I'm a practitioner of hoodoo, which is that American religion that developed in the South. And it's been practicing forever, but I think really developed as a religion in the late 1700s. And then also a practitioner of Ifa, which is a Yoruba religious tradition originating out of West Africa, out of Nigeria, the Yoruba people. And there's a large Ifa community here in Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm a part of that community. So it's been nice to have some structure to my spiritual practice and be able to practice in community with people. And I venerate my ancestors. That's part of hoodoo, but I just think that that's important. I'm very much venerating my ancestors. Yeah, it's kind of all parts of my life. And I'm out in nature a lot too. That's definitely part of my spiritual practice.
I have so many questions. I have so many. Yeah. I'm so intrigued. This is already resonating so much for me. So we're in the Lower Mainland in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So like Pacific Northwest. So when you're talking about the mountains, I'm like, I live right beside a mountain. And grew up in the church, grew up like kind of Pentecostal and then left the church. So I can imagine that at a sleepover, scaring all the Christian girls. I would have been one of those girls getting really scared by tarot. I'm so curious about how you witnessing sort of like your mom sort of taking bits and pieces where she could find and her experience, I'm assuming like leaving the church or doing kind of an about face to that form, that kind of, I would say in my own experience, historically oppressive form of religion. I'm curious about the piecing things together. Mm-hmm. Because so much of what I'm craving is doing is that. I'm curious about like what you learned from your mom's experience and how that's affected you in accessing community and how important community has been in your spiritual practice versus, you know, learning about it through your mom and your, you know, just what that was like for you.
That's a great question. The bits and pieces part, I think my mother represents and is a member of a lineage of Black people in the diaspora trying to connect largely through a political decision, right? Of just being tired of what many would call the white, quote unquote, white man's religion, right? That happened in the 60s. When people started massively leaving the Black church. So my mom is of that, right? And so I think a lot of Black folks started piecing together kind of whatever we could find, right? And so thinking about Jambalaya, Louis Atisha's book that came out in 1987, and she first became initiated into Lukumi, which is a Cuban or Santeria Cuban religion. And then since her initiation into Lukumi, there's been a massive amount of African-Americans connecting to what we now call the Sheshe tradition or Ifa, which is more Nigerian tradition. And I asked Tish why she connected to Lukumi. I was like, it's Cuban. Why wouldn't you connect to the Sheshe tradition? And which is currently what African-Americans connect to mostly. And she said, well, you know, that was what was available to us, right? That was the only thing that Cubans basically came to New York in the 60s after the revolution and introduced African-Americans to Lukumi. And she's like, that's what we knew. And I think that that's kind of where my mom was too. That's what she knew. That's what was accessible. There wasn't a lot of writing on Africana spiritual practice. I think it's probably in the last maybe 20 years, maybe, that there's been more writing, that's been more accessible. And then also Ile's or Ifa communities tend to be closed traditions too. And so that means that people don't necessarily, you have to know somebody and then be kind of brought into the Ile, brought into the community. And they're few and far between. My Ile is 25 years old, and that's here in Atlanta in a Black Mecca. Kemetic traditions, I think those came about in the 60s too. People were really fascinated with Egypt and connecting to a Black civilization and kind of reclaiming and being, you know, affirming that Black people have civilization. And so Egypt was the first place that they often went to assert that claim. So it was a mix of things. And I think there's just more accessibility now to and knowledge about, especially about hoodoo, especially. I mean, hoodoo has really undertaken a resurgence in the last, maybe even a decade, but at least the last 20 years. And I think people are understanding it more as a religion. And there's more conversations and more openness of Ifa communities too. And so I think people are finding that more readily accessible. And I think especially through the internet too. I mean, there's so many Facebook groups, Instagram, TikTok, all kinds of things that are making it more available to people. And so that's a beautiful thing. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm curious about the ancestor veneration piece.
Yeah.
And as like a personal curiosity, like what does that look like? What does that mean for you?
Well, first, I just want to shout out. I'm excited. I'm going to be taking an intuition course with Tatiana Taro in next Saturday.
That's awesome.
And I'm really excited about it because it is very much about connecting with one's ancestors. So ancestors are an important part of hoodoo. It's very much a religion about venerating one's ancestors. So I have an ancestor altar. I honor both my African-American heritage and also my Sicilian heritage. So everybody's picture is up there on the altar. I've gotten in the habit of reading them in the morning. Usually I kind of go when I'm in a mood or something and I need to talk to somebody. But I am trying to get away from that. And not only inform a better relationship with my ancestors, not just when I need something, right? So I go in the morning and I always have fresh flowers on my altar and I knock 3 times. I don't know exactly what tradition that's come from, but I've heard of it in Ifa traditions and in hoodoo also. And I just greet them and pray and meditate and just think about what my intentions are for this day. I think it's just so important to cultivate that kind of intuition and cultivate that the voice, the ability to hear when spirit or one's ancestors or in Ifa traditions, we call it one's Ori, is speaking to oneself. So I think that meditation and being present and being still and also being mindful of substance uses like alcohol or drugs can kind of cloud the voice. Yeah, and just being able to hear that, because I think even before we talk about structured religion and ritual and practice and the ways that things are done, the thing that comes first, most traditions will tell you this, is to build a relationship with one's ancestors, but then also build a relationship with oneself, right? The knowing, the voice, the ori, the heart,
inner God,
inner God, whatever we want to call it, right? I think it's also a matter of committing to one's growth. You are honoring your ancestors, not only by the flowers and the plate of food that you lead out for them, which you should do, which was good to do, but also through showing a commitment to your own growth and and practicing that, right? And practicing a love and compassion for others and breaking the kinds of generational harm that has been in the past, you know, or traumas or healing from that.
Thank you so much. That leads really well into our theme for the season has been transformative justice for self. So how we can transform the conditions within and around ourselves to support healing and growth. And so I'm wondering for you how you've experienced the relationship between your spiritual practice and change. You know, you're talking about this growth and how it sounds like it's a very integral part of your spiritual practice or how you understand the place of it in your life. I'm wondering, yeah, how you experience change within the context of spirituality.
So Hoodoo and Ifa are both religions very much about change. It's very much about divine intervention in some form or another. People make offerings to the Odisha or sacrifice Abel to the Odisha to bring in a particular desired result. People might go to Oshun for children. People might go to Ogun for technology issues, right? Or yeah, maybe for change. And they're offered sacrifice for these desires after divination. So it's very much about, so the energies, the spirits, the deities are very much a part of the process of creating change in one's life. I think in Hoodoo, it's similar, right? They're the magic, the spells, some might call the rituals, they're often about creating change in one's life. And I think Hoodoo is a religion that was developed in a moment of, well, during slavery, right? And so it's very much about creating practical, tangible changes in practitioners' lives. It's about remaining safe. So it's about keeping families together. It was about creating some kind of internal forms of justice within enslaved communities. Yeah, so change is just integral to Africana religions. I often think about the relationship between destiny and change because in Ifa, it is said that before you are born, Yori, or you, your energy, your spirit, meets with God and decides what your life is going to be like or what you're going to do when you arrive at Earth, right? And so you're going to be a piano player, you're going to have these kinds of challenges, you might have children, and you might, whatever, you're agreeing with Oludamade. So you come to Earth and you are fulfilling this destiny that has been predetermined between the Odi and Oludamade. So if there's destiny, if there is the belief that there are things that are coming into our lives that are predetermined, then what is the relationship between that and magic and creating the life that one desires, right? Or what is the relationship between that and offering sacrifice, offering to the Odisha to change the course of one's life? And what I found was that some scholars and some practitioners understand both to be true at the same time without much incompatibility. We are destined. There are things, some things that are in our destiny, but then there's also this element of, I don't know, some might call will or power or ability to harness energies and create one's desired outcome too. So these two things kind of exist simultaneously, that there are ways that you can live more according to your destiny through magic, through calling in what aligns you with your destiny. Like something's calling me towards academia. I don't know what it is, but something's calling me towards academia, right? The magic that I might do to reach that destiny of being in academia that seems like my Ori wants me to do, that magic is pushing me towards that destiny, right? That's how I see change and manifesting and creating change in one's life.
It sounds like the way that you're describing destiny and magic, like all of these sort of elements as almost like things that push you or pull you or kind of invite you along this journey. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you mentioning that it's like a both and, like they're both sort of like working mm-hmm. in relationship with each other. I'm curious of if you could share mm-hmm. any moments that you felt those pieces being in friction. Mm-hmm. Because I very much resonate with the notion of like, I feel like I was put on this earth to do something. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding myself more and more able to listen to intuition and the guides and the people that have been placed in my life that are reminding me of that. Mm-hmm. And also there are people who are not reminding me of that and are, you know, making it challenging to be on that course. And so I'm curious if there's an element of troubleshooting destiny or like, how do you mm-hmm. deal with the pieces that seem like they might be in opposition, in tension with each other?
Patience. Patience. I'm stubborn and a little bit of a control freak. I think it feels like it's in friction when I really want something or I really think that something is really good for me or I need it to happen and it's not happening. And that's where this element of destiny and faith come in, where it's like just having faith that the ancestors, the Odisha, that everyone, my guides have my back and they got me. And I think when I'm clear about what I want, that I'm more able to say no to the things that are not in alignment with that or say yes to the things that are. And that directs me more towards exactly what it is that I'm feeling called towards than anything that might throw me off course. So yeah, a lot of patience and a lot of faith and a lot of communication. I think that's where things like divination come into that are useful, right? We can use tarot to get that confirmation that, okay, I'm anxious right now that things aren't going to work out how I want them to, but the cards can help, or whatever forms of divination one chooses to use can help confirm that, yes, you know, you're on the right path, or maybe you're not on the right path. Maybe you are distracted and as an important lesson that you need to learn before you can actualize whatever it is that you're wanting to change in your life or heal or create or whatever. Yeah, divination, dreams, talking to your people, those are the tools that help build the faith.
So it sounds like you have a lot of tools, and you mentioned structures as well before. You have community. Despite having those things, does it ever feel hard to access those things? Do you ever experience like spiritual blocks?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all the time. You know, community is, people are people. Also, you know, and there's always tensions and different kinds of communities. I see an online spaces as a community too. They're important to me. I think I experience blocks when I'm very frustrated, when I'm really, really want something to happen that's not happening for me. And I think I've experienced my spirit guides telling me to calm down. Mm-hmm. To just take a second, take a breath, and calm down. It's okay. Yeah. And I think that I also go through periods where I'm not necessarily as in touch, as connected, right? And I think those are times when I'm not in a practice. Sometimes for me, academia can kind of get me outside of the spiritual and more into the intellectual. And so I'll think about religion in terms of this kind of theoretical sense, right, as I'm reading, but then get a little bit more disconnected from my own ancestors and my own spiritual practice. I mean, it can be like months. It can be months where I'm totally disconnected. And then I often reorient myself by spending time in nature or making a practice. I mean, I think this thing that's so important, making a practice and a habit of being at my altar and making offerings and talking. And I think, and also finding different mentors and seeking out mentorship is so crucial too, because sometimes when I'm feeling disconnected, I'll often take classes. I'll take like this, I'm excited about the new class on Saturday. I take hoodoo classes, or I'll learn from my Ifa community, or I try to connect with people and try to learn from people if I'm feeling a little bit more kind of disconnected from my own spirituality.
I'm really glad you brought up the topic of disconnection. And my question is almost like, what happens if you're just like, you feel like you've always been disconnected, like just your whole life is disconnection? As I mentioned, like having grown up in the church and wanting so deeply to reconnect with some of the spiritual traditions of my people. I'm Kenyan. Like, I was born in Vancouver, but my family is Kenyan. And we're Luo, so we're descendants of folks that migrated down the Nile over like thousands of years. And it's so fucking frustrating trying to find information. And most of it is, you know, anthropological or really like really research-based information about Luo ancestral spiritual practices that are not written by white folks, mm-hmm. and or are not written by the Seventh Day Adventist Church that are, you know, that's like framed in like these people practice some weird shit, and you know, and there's so many parts of me that have being so far away from ancestral place and home and space and not feeling like you're from there and feeling like you're from here but also not from here, that craves that connection. And at the same time, I think we're in this day and age where I personally feel so sensitive to not wanting to be appropriative of the spiritual practices of peoples that I don't belong to. And so I'm curious of like, if you have any thoughts on that. Like, I really appreciated before when you mentioned your mom and so many folks being able to practice what they knew or what they had access to. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that accessibility and, yeah, if you have any thoughts about like the perpetual disconnection and sort of like how would you advise or suggest some of us go about connecting? Is it a get in where you fit in? Like, is it like a just like look for different kinds of resources or different kind? I have no idea.
I mean, it's so true for so many of us. The first thing that comes to mind, I was just recently reading about Baba Menahoshi, who was a African-American Awalao, some of the first in the Ifa tradition. His philosophy was combined Vodun and Ifa Odisha traditions, and I think Kikongo traditions and African-American hoodoo, just a lot of things. What worked was his philosophy. He would say that because African diasporic people, a lot of us are of so many different African makeups, that it's all Black, right? It's all of access and use to us as African diasporic peoples. And also that trade and the blending and the exchange of information of religious traditions was happening on the continent of Africa way before colonialism, and religion grows and develops and changes. Mm. And that's how, so that's really how religion is formed. People are just finding ways to connect to the divine. I think that's what really religion is, structures and protocol to do that. So yeah, get in where you fit in. I mean, right? Like, just kind of find what works for you. And as someone of African descent practicing African descended traditions, that is totally yours to do. And I don't think that there's anything appropriative about Black folks practicing Black religions. We're all just trying to figure it out. And not only Black religions, but I think the ways that European traditions are being reimagined through a Black lens. I have an article on Tarot and how Black folks have reinterpreted tarot through an Africana religious lens. I think that it is more than okay to find whatever resonates and kind of go from there. I too don't know a lot about Kenya, and I don't know about the religious traditions there. There's so much more that needs to be done. But the advice that's always been given to me, and I would say most practitioners would say, is just start with the ancestors. That's where it starts. Mm. Developing a relationship with them through whatever divination tools or through dreams or through symbols. Maybe there's information that you can receive directly from them. And like I said before, I think that that just comes with practice, with habit. Sit at your altar every day. Have some pictures of whomever you know you can call on, grandma, grandpa, whomever. Write, journal, meditate, stay present. The messages will come. Hmm. Leave some offerings, right? The messages will come. Spiritual tools are mostly about symbols, and they're mostly about communicating some kind of message and calling on some kind of energy. It's like rose brings in love, calls on love, because rose is representative of love. Red, you know, we kind of tend to think about romance and you have these associations. Think about what are some of the tools or the items that have meaning for you. What do they represent? What are they calling on? What are they bringing on, bringing into your life? Or who are they calling into your life, alive or dead? What might your ancestors like? What kind of foods might they like? Place those at your altar. They'll call on that energy. I think that's really what a lot of the spiritual practice is calling on and working with and moving energies and asking and honoring the people before us.
Thank you so much. Deeply.
I'm wondering if we could also bring in another aspect of identity. I'm wondering if you've been able to find space for queerness in your spiritual mm-hmm. practices. And, you know, so many queer and trans people have experienced so much harm and oppression within religious and spiritual sites. And I'm wondering if you've had an opportunity to experience something else.
Yeah. I think queerness really shows up in Hoodoo and Ifa communities, and I just think maybe in Africana religious or spiritual communities in general, or spaces or thought, in two ways. One, I think a lot of leadership, a lot of practitioners are queer, queer and trans, right? Africana religions can, although some spaces haven't, can offer queer and trans folks quite a bit of affirmation around sexuality and gender, because the Odisha are queer. Many of them look over queer and trans people. There's a deity, Oshinmare, who is attributed with trans women and trans folks, and is depicted wearing a skirt and has kind of a fluid gender identity, right? Oshun is the patron spirit of feminine gay men. There's a lot of queerness among the Odishas. So I think there's that calls people to Odisha traditions. In Hoodoo, this person Heslov shared with me, they said that Hoodoo, it's never a matter of if queer folks are in or out of Hoodoo. Hoodoo just is, because it's the material, it's the practice, the herbs, the ancestors, the Simbi, which are deities. And then I think also queerness in terms of the non-normative, queerness as in the outside of opposition to heteronormative, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, right? And I think that Africana religions and practitioners, by choosing a religions that are directly oppose, right, Christian supremacy, just by their very existence, are choosing a queerness, right, an outsideness and an otherness that has been persecuted under the Christian church. So I think those two ways in which queerness is very prominent. And there is a history of Odisha communities excluding queer and trans folks too. fewer now, but there are some that are can still be homophobic and transphobic. But those are the people, right? Those are the people with just their messed up ideas. And that's not the Odisha themselves. That's not the real theology or belief system of the religions. That's just Christian supremacy in another form.
Thank you for that. That feels really affirming to hear. And thank you for everything today. I could talk to you forever. Honestly, I wish we didn't have time limits, but maybe as a final question, I could just ask you, what has been maybe the biggest surprise of spiritual practice for you or your spiritual journey?
How much I love it. Because in some ways, my spiritual journey has also been my professional journey. It's also been my career. And so learning, I'm looking at my books right now as I'm answering you, because I have such a deep love for all of the work that has come before me. I think that a lot of people who are scholars of Africana religions are also practitioners of Africana religions. Ultimately, the quest is not just an intellectual quest, it's a heart quest, right? I came to this practice because of my mama, because of my own connections to my ancestors and ancestral practices, because of internal self. It's been something that's been a part of my life, my entire life, but the past 6 years, it's been very much a part of my life. So that's all I really think about and talk about as a in my career, and I still love it so much. I still love the potential for change, the potential for tapping into a power that is outside of the nation state, the potential for tapping into a power to create the worlds that we want. Let me speak for myself. Create the world that I want in my little world, in my students, in my writing, in my stuff. And that power feels like it's within me. It's not necessarily something that I have to depend on someone else to affirm. I think my practice in Africana religions, spirituality, has just consistently affirmed my power.
That's incredible to hear. Thank you so much. We're so grateful getting to share space with you and,
thank you.
And learn from all of your work and your wisdom. And
thank you.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to see you.
Okay, this was an incredibly fascinating and affirming and exciting conversation. I know you felt the same way. What stood out for you in this conversation? What's been sitting with you since we spoke to Marcelite?
Well, first of all, thank you for bringing Marcelite. Like, you know, this is a person that you know, and I'm really grateful that we were able to sit with her and have her just kind of walk through her journey to the spirituality and the spiritual practices that she engages in, and the fact that she's a practitioner. I just really genuinely love the fact that she started off by articulating like her mom's experience, which was why I asked the question of like, tell me more about your mom sort of pulling together the pieces, whatever she had available to her. I don't know. It's so powerful for me because I've been so scared of doing just that, of like pulling whatever pieces I can together. And I want to talk with you about why I think that is. I think I have some immediate insights of my own, my own fears.
Yeah, I was about to ask. Yeah, why is that so scary for you?
I don't know. I think it's like, I feel like I have to do it right if I'm going to do it at all. Like there's still an element of perfection.
Yeah.
And it's not perfection even. It's really just like, if I'm going to do it, I want to honor it. I want to honor the traditions and I want to come correct. And so I really valued and deeply appreciated the imperfect path, like the meandering path, the pulling bits and pieces, like it kind of gave me permission, or it gives me permission. And it's also helped me better reflect on, yeah, like where it is that I'm getting stuck on or hung up on. I don't know, maybe I'm seeing it as like a work project where it's like, unless I have all the pieces together and I know all the answers, that's when I can start, as opposed to, well, what do I already know? Where can I find some information? What is available to me? Who are the people who are already doing and practicing Afro-Caribbean spiritual traditional practices? Like, I think it just was super inviting, the way that she described that.
Absolutely. And where can you be curious and open to sort of the mystery of it? I definitely relate to that perfectionism. And I think that was one of the reasons why I found it so relieving when she said that she sometimes experiences blocks too, or doesn't feel super connected. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of, for me, imposter syndrome around some of this stuff, where it's like, okay, she has this lineage and she has all this education and she's part of these communities and she's a practitioner. Mm-hmm. And maybe there is the idea for me that if you have certain things, then you will feel this sort of intensely strong connection and sort of knowingness around spirituality. And that's what makes you a spiritual person. And that's where this all has to come from. Mm-hmm. And that feels very... I don't want to say unattainable, but
kind of all or nothing. Like, it is a bit unattainable. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the idea that we can maybe start where we are, and the process maybe of seeking and asking and being open is maybe the most central part of it. I think that's a really interesting kind of reframe.
Yeah. I also think that my... all or nothing, like you mentioned, perfectionist, like whatever approach, I think it also is definitely painted by my earliest experiences with any kind of spiritual practice, which was, you know, in the church. And so much of what I remember and took from being a church girl for a long ass time was the importance of fellowship and community and doing it with other people. And that it's also, or that it, for me, also kind of felt like, despite biblical scripture talking about this shit is not for show, it's not for like other people to see, it's for you to have as your own practice, it's for you to have your relationship with God is between you and God. You close the door and you pray. It's not for this sort of like the rigmarole of other people noticing or being, you know, all that stuff. I think that there is still a part of me that really feels like I can't access it or practice it unless I can, one, do it perfectly, but two, I'm holding myself to this weird standard that I have to be able to like bring my spiritual practice to like the community or something. And I don't know if that even, I haven't really thought about it beyond me just saying it right now in like a intentional way, but I feel like I want to be able to have these connections with my ancestors, with my lineage, with our ways of honoring ourselves and our wisdom and all that stuff. And I want it for myself, and I don't want it to be co-opted or become this thing that I have to articulate publicly. Like, I don't know if that even makes sense. Like, there's something about the privacy of it. There's something about maybe like that I want to keep it sacred. And I'm trying to divorce that from being scared to talk about it, or because it's like the fear of talking about it comes from somebody being like, oh, you're not doing that right. This is how you're supposed to be venerating your ancestors. This is how you're supposed to be doing that. And it's like, I don't want to keep it sacred for fear. I want to keep it sacred because it's that special and meaningful for me. But there's so much that gets in the way of my ability to connect with it one of the things being the fact that there's not that much information about a lot of the ancestral spiritual practices of my people, specifically in East Africa. Like, we're a Nilotic people, and so much information that exists has been made by anthropologists, people of the church. So it's like, you're not even getting, I don't know, there's something about the purity of it that I think I'm lamenting that I don't have access to. And that feels important to name.
Absolutely. I think there's huge loss there. There's huge grief mm-hmm. there. And I think that a lot of people who are part of diasporas, for various reasons, many of which root back to colonialism and violence and oppression, both past and present, don't have a strong connection or a lot of knowledge about the spiritual practices of our ancestors. And I think that's a huge loss. I think it's one of the biggest losses of mm-hmm. of yeah. colonialism. And I so appreciated how inviting Marcelite was in terms of encouraging people who don't have that connection to start where they are, to explore what resonates with them, and maybe not feel too restrictive in terms of, you know, saying to you, like, if you're Black and these are African derived religions, you can feel comfortable taking what resonates for you. You're not appropriating. That's not like the violence of, you know, maybe a non-Black person doing that. And I think, you know, for each of us to apply that to our own kind of situation in the regions that our ancestors are from, I think, again, it felt relieving that maybe we could start where we can, start with what we can find that resonates with us, and then be open to actually, as we build our practices, the potential of receiving messages directly from our ancestors or from spirit.
I think
one day.
Yeah, I love that a lot, because it's like that encouragement to just get started.
Yeah.
It's not about like seeing the whole path ahead of you. Mm-hmm. It's about also anticipating and being open and being receptive to the alchemy of change, right? Like the alchemy of like what information you're going to receive as you begin, as you are in it. And I think that that's like a really, yeah, it's really inviting. It's still, it's really inviting. And I think the reason that I'm so slow to process this is I think it directly challenges a lot of the perfectionist stuff, right? That it's not about like, mm-hmm. it's not about having like the manual so that you know exactly what to do and exactly what to say and all this stuff. It's like things that, what she described are things that I can begin and that I have begun to practice by way of just carving out time. Mm-hmm. That carving out time is part of it. That feels great to me. It's not about doing it perfectly. It's about doing it. Surprise, surprise.
Well, I wonder too, I'm thinking about maybe the influences that might be at play here when it comes to this perfectionism, because I'm thinking about the ways that maybe these ways of trying to decolonize our spiritual practices, trying to go back and find something closer to what our ancestors might have practiced before colonialism came in and changed everything. It kind of aligns with some of our social justice, anti-oppression communities, which, as we've talked about at length, are very perfectionist and have very sort of rigid rules around this is acceptable, this is not acceptable, yeah. this is how you can do things, this is how you can't
right,
do
right,
things.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you've told me growing up in the church that there was a lot of judgment around who's sort of the most holy or who is performing the religion the best and all of that. And I'm wondering if that also mm-hmm. might be, you know, a source of that perfectionism of there is a right way and a wrong way to do this. And if you're doing it the wrong way, you know, that's really bad and everyone will judge you and all of that.
Yeah. And I think you're on the money with that. I think it's also an element of so much gets lost, literally in translation. So much gets lost when you don't have folks to translate the language of how something, a story, a fable, a practice, what is the intention? What does that mean? So much of it is so place-based and context-specific. And then that coupled with the perfectionist stuff, it's like when you do have access to any information that is written by somebody of your lineage, you're like, that's the practice. That's exactly what it's supposed to be. It says it really clear. And I, as a former church girl, read it like the fucking Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's it. That's the word of God. You shall not mm-hmm. question it, as opposed to being able to appreciate, which I wish all fucking people who believe so strongly in Christianity would be able to take what they read in the Bible with a grain of salt and think context, place, language. Mm-hmm. It's yes, the history of my own experience being in church and feeling super judged and judging myself. And it's also what you do have access to still. Like, there's colonialism just so through and through and through. The fact that I can't speak my language, it's like all of these blocks that I think have made me honestly feel like I'm never going to have access to it because I can't speak. And it's like putting up a bunch of different conditions. I can't do this until I'm on my home territory. I can't. It's like kicking the possibility of accessing this practice that I want so badly so far into the future that it becomes impossible. And the impossibility of it, it's so much easier to be like, colonialism did that shit, than to be like, carve 10 minutes and sit in silence. And so I'm trying my best right now, even in this conversation, to be agentic and know more where my own resistance is. Because ultimately for me, it's like, I just want to be able to convene and connect to my guides. Because I know that they're working. I know. I'd be seeing 11111 all the time. And the past month has been filled with these signs and these symbols. And so being able to convene in that way, I think, is what I ultimately need. And I think getting to the heart of that is fruitful. Like, that we're having this conversation and I'm recognizing, even in talking to you, that what I want is just to be in connection. Then the connection comes from spending the 10 minutes, like, over time, right? And it's not like a, once I have the crystals and all the things and this and the all the pieces and I light the candle, then I'll feel something different. I think that there's a bit of instant gratification that I'm also trying to work through, is wanting things immediately, and this is not that.
Yeah, I like what you said about exploring where the resistances are, because I think that is so fruitful. And I am not even completely sure where they all are in me. But I think, like you said, carving out that time, it would maybe give me an opportunity to find out. I think spirituality and spiritual practice in so many ways is in direct opposition to so much of our life and our world. It's like the opposite way of being. Taking that time to sit in silence and to really be open to sort of the invisible and the mysterious and the magical and all of that, I think it to me just feels opposite of what I'm expected to do all day, which is do, produce, right? Know, say, talk, right. All of these things. Yeah. And so I think it can be really difficult to carve out that time. And then I think there is maybe a lot of fear around, maybe I'm not capable of making this connection.
Oh, girl.
Maybe, even though, you know, it's like, yeah. I know people close to me who have such strong connections and get really strong, like, kind of psychic messages mm-hmm. back. Mm-hmm. And that's never been me. And I think that there is, like, a big part of me that's like, maybe I'm not capable of it. And
same.
Yeah, it's maybe scary to go and find out.
What you just described of, like, noticing that some others, people around you, have such great ability to make those connections. That's part of what I was mentioning before about, like, we're looking to other people. And I think that's important. And I also think it's important for us to look internal to ourselves. Like, I don't, so much of my own personal gripes with organized religion, Christianity, and lots of other just dogmatic ways of going about spiritual practice is that it's so performance-based. It's very performative. It's looking to your left and to your right. And I know we need to be relational, and I think that's different. Like, we need to be able to know how we impact people around us. That's different than comparing where somebody else is in their practice, where somebody else is in their journey. And I also believe that even within, like, let's say it's my own family or your own family, like, if there's a sibling that I have that's making those connections and has that, there might be messages that they're getting that I'm not getting because it's not for me. Mm-hmm. You're so right about so much of what we're talking about feels so counter to kind of a Eurocentric framework of convening, connecting. Like, Marcelite talked about giving gifts and, like, offerings. Like, you know, you do need to make sure that you're bringing something to your altar. And it's so easy, even in that, I'm like, oh, it really speaks to me. And then I'm like, what would I get? Oh, it have to be organic. It have to be, you know, it's like, I wish that I was able, and I want for myself, really, to trust enough that my guides, that the spirits that are not on this plane that I'm on, like you said before, will give me the information to help me course correct. Like, there has to be some element of trusting that. And that in some ways is part of, like, you got to be able to trust that and not always look to your left and your right and see, like, oh, this person does this, I'm going to do that exact same thing. It's like, maybe it's going to be different for you. I don't even know if I'm making any fucking sense. I just feel like there is, it's not an individuality to it. It's like there's a personal, intrapersonal. There's, like, something that's happening specific to you, inside of you, to me, inside of me. And I think that we would benefit so much if we honored that there is that presence within ourselves that's, like, longing and yearning for those connections, as opposed to being like, well, that person's so connected. Do you know what I mean? And that's not, there's no shade against you. I'm just like, I feel the same way. So, how can I honor the things that are coming up for me?
Yeah, I think it's really an important reminder that we are each unique. And so each of our spiritual practices will be unique, even if it looks similar to somebody else's. Even if it's in the same tradition as someone else's, it'll still be unique to us. And I think spirituality is a series of relationships. You know, it's relationships with spirit, with the earth, with your ancestors, with other people. And so, you know, every relationship as well is unique. I also thought, you know, a huge thing that has been sitting with me is the way Marcelie talked about how these religious traditions that she studies were very much based in creating real, tangible change and justice in the lives of the people who practiced it. And that felt so incredibly powerful to me that, you know, it's not about just an afterlife or the things that happen in between death and birth. It's something that is about what's happening here and now as well. And I think that is so incredibly powerful for people experiencing oppression, including, you know, she's talking about African-derived religions and the experiences of Black folks who are practicing these religious traditions. I think it's also so important for the queer and trans folks who live in this world that is so incredibly hateful and oppressive. And I love the way that Marcelie talked about how queer and trans identities are inherent in a lot of these traditions. And I know when I've studied traditions around connecting with the ancestors, I found that a lot of people are able to find that unconditional love and acceptance from their ancestors that they can't get from their family or from their communities here because of this actually very new phenomenon of homophobia and transphobia. And that actually often when queer and trans people go to their ancestors sort of asking like, I'm trans or I'm queer, do you accept me? Often the ancestors are almost confused because it's like they don't know how to understand the question because it's like, well, that's not a separate thing.
You're part of me. That's like a,
that's just, you know, who we all are.
Yeah. It's all acceptable. Yeah. I really resonate with what tangible, practical, material ways that spiritual practice offers some form of refuge or respite or a framework for how we survive. Because those things have existed for forever. And I, like the Christian version of me, there's this scripture in the Bible that's like faith without works is dead. And that I think is really important. And I'm sure that is translated across so many other religions that it's not a unique thing. Sorry, Christians. that this like notion of we don't just do that work. We don't just connect and convene with our ancestors. We don't just connect and convene with the divine. We don't just talk to God. We don't just pray for fun. It's the way that we are able to, like, one, I think, make meaning, but two, be able to address the inhumanity, address, challenge, strengthen our resolve, build a sense of inner voice, trust our intuition, understand the things that we deserve inherently as beings on this plane. Like, I think that so much of it is got to be action oriented. That's not me trying to say that, like, if you're not feeling more worthy from your religion and a greater sense of how you need to be showing up on this earth, then your religion sucks. But I do think for myself, like, what I'm looking for the most is some of that guidance, like some of that, like, this is how we want to be moving. This is what we want to be. This is how we want to be showing up. And it's not just about me. It can't be just about me because so much of the things that have been put on my heart and in my spirit aren't just about me. And so I take a lot of comfort in what Marcelite said about that same thing, about like, it's got to be material changes that we can make in our lives, and that it's not just about setting ourselves up for the life that we want or giving ourselves what we need, but also it's like, that's where the relational is so important because our ancestors also lived in relation. It's not like they were just fucking islands onto themselves, like, right? They were part of whole communities and played a role in their communities as well. And so it's like thinking of ourselves as those future ancestors. It's like, that means we also have to be playing a role in our communities, albeit in a different place and space and context, but like we still have that responsibility, I think.
Absolutely. And when we think about transformative justice for self, I think we are taking it into an individual context, but it is still so relational.
Yes.
And I think this is a really beautiful demonstration of that connection, of the ways that our individual practice can actually connect us to our communities and to our ancestors and to everything that exists. And these relationships with spirit, with the earth, with other practitioners, with our ancestors, they can really, like you said, inspire us to know what we deserve, what is the change that we are seeking. And it also connects us to forces much more powerful than us
that I think support us to create that change. And that change doesn't exist just for us. Mm-hmm. It ripples outwards, right? And I think so often we feel so isolated and powerless in this world. And I think connecting to our ancestors, connecting to spirit, connecting to all these things that are so much bigger than us, it's like maybe helps us to connect to the fact that in our desire for change, we actually aren't alone, even if physically it's just me here. I'm so connected to so much that's bigger that can support me in that change making.
Trusting that is hard, but I'm betting that with building that trust that we are connected to so much more than just ourselves, I think that's what Marsley was talking about. I imagine that's what she was talking about when she was like, you spend 10 minutes and you just wait to receive. It's like there's a trust that is inherent in that. There's like a, an appreciation that there are things we cannot see and probably can't feel just yet that are coming our way. And it's like creating an openness. And I think that also means creating an openness to hear from others what their wisdoms are. Mm-hmm. I think that that's an element of my own spiritual practice that is really important to me. And that means I have to be discerning as to who I'm around and who I identify as folks in my corner, like that work that I have to do. But my spirit helps me with that determination. So much of what I think we miss when we're disconnected from spiritual traditional practices of our own people and places is the ability to appreciate that our ancestors also had like communities around them, collectives around them, making decisions together about how the clan or the group or the team or like or the family or the unit was going to be moving. People had roles and all those roles were interconnected with each other. And it's like, as you recognize the connections between carving out time to just receive that information from our spirits, from our guides, from our ancestors, I think we also should be mirroring that with our guides that are kind of on this plane as well. It's like who around us can give us some insights, like who gives us that, like where do we get that from? And I'm not saying like talk to your pastor. I mean, I guess talk, it's not that, right? It's like I think that there are many ways that spirit decides to impart wisdom or knowledge onto us. And I think that they're like, as we're open and in our own homes to like receive, it means that we have to also have an openness in some way, shape or form to what we're receiving as we're just like living life, how things are resonating with us, what people are saying around us, to us, the energy, like just there's an attunement, I think is what I'm speaking to. How does that resonate for you?
It resonates, and it's just making me reflect on how spirituality, as we talk about it, it's starting to feel like a container and a reflection of like everything else that we've talked about all season. You know, the ways that it really is asking us to let go of perfectionism, to carve out space for a connection to something different in a world that's, you know, very busy and very opposed to that. It's asking us to really get a lot more comfortable with not knowing. It's asking us to prioritize the relational. And it can be such a container for things like grief. It can be a source of hope. It can be where we go when we're feeling stagnant. It can bring in love that helps to cultivate a self-love in us. It can be something that heals our shame. Like it just feels like this, if we allow it to be, could be the structure and the container that allows us to do all of this other work that we've been talking about all season.
I love that. And I appreciate even if we allow it to be, because that's where we have autonomy. Like that's our power. And I think I've learned over time how much I've diminished that, even in that little like minute choice, like if I allow it and allow like that word, if that word to me is so powerful, I feel like it offers some sense of choice in a world where we're often told there are no real choices. And that's the reality, because we're living within systems of oppression in which our choices are even constrained, even though we have a lot of agency in this society, let's say, compared to other places and spaces and times. I think there's something really powerful about saying even that, yeah, that framing of if we allow it, that's where we have the power. And I'm hell-bent on always articulating and identifying where we have power. Because one thing about this world, it works overtime to disempower us and to make us feel like we have no ability to choose for ourselves, to connect to ourselves and each other. Being able to choose that for ourselves is our power.
I love that. And I guess it feels a little bit paradoxical, but I guess I'm leaving this conversation feeling connected to that power and agency that I have, and also feeling very humbled. Mm-hmm. You know, feeling like there is so much more power that is outside of me that I don't understand and am not even a little bit aware of yet. And I think it's that humility that makes me want to find out, you know, and feel like I can, that I can make that choice to be open to finding out.